This is Chapter Day. I'm Jim Fleming. I'm reading again from A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles, published by Viking. It's 1954, and Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov has plans. Oh, he's still under house arrest in the Metropole Hotel across from the Kremlin. He's been under house arrest for more than 30 years. Now his daughter, as he thinks of her, Sophia, has accepted an offer to perform with the Soviet Youth Orchestra in Paris. And that has meant the beginnings of a plan. Chapter 22 of A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. At 6:45 on the 11th of June, Count Alexander Rostov stood in Suite 417, dressed in the white jacket of the Boyarsky, ensuring that the place settings were properly arranged and his men properly attired, before opening the doors for the 1954 combined dinner of the Presidium and the Council of Ministers. 11 days earlier, as we know, the Count had been excused from this duty rather unceremoniously. But early on the afternoon of the 10th of June, Maître de Duras arrived at the Boyarsky's daily meeting with distressing news. For some time, he said, he had been experiencing a tremor of the hands consistent with the onset of palsy. After a troubled night's sleep, he had awakened to discover that the condition had grown considerably worse. By way of illustration, he held his right hand over the table where it trembled like a leaf. Émile looked on with an expression of shock. What sort of divinity, he seemed to be thinking, would devise a world in which an aging man's malady afflicts the very attribute that has set him apart from his fellow men and elevated him in the eyes of all? What sort of divinity, Émile? The very same who rendered Beethoven deaf and Monet blind. For what the Lord giveth is precisely what he cometh later to take away. But if Émile's face expressed an almost sacrilegious indignation at his friend's condition, the bishop's expressed the grimace of the inconvenienced. Noting the manager's annoyance, André sought to set his mind at ease. "Oh, you needn't worry, Manager Leplevsky. I have already contacted Comrade Prop at the Kremlin and assured him that while I cannot oversee tomorrow night's event, head waiter Rostov will be assuming my responsibilities. Needless to say," the maître d' added, "Comrade Prop was greatly relieved by the news." "Of course," said the bishop. In reporting that Comrade Prop was greatly relieved to have head waiter Rostov at the helm of this dinner of state, Andrei was not exaggerating. Born 10 years after the revolution, Comrade Prop didn't know that head waiter Rostov was under house arrest at the Metropole. He didn't even know that head waiter Rostov was a former person. What he did know, and from personal experience, was that head waiter Rostov could be counted upon to attend to every detail on the table and respond immediately to the slightest hint of a customer's dissatisfaction. And though Comrade Prop was still relatively inexperienced in the ways of the Kremlin, he was experienced enough to know that any shortcomings in the evening would be laid at his door as surely as if he had set the table, cooked the meal, and poured the wine himself. Comrade Prop personally communicated his relief to the Count during a brief meeting on the morning of the event. At a table for two in the Boyarsky, the young liaison reviewed with the Count, quite unnecessarily, all the details of the evening. The timing, the doors were to be opened promptly at 9 o'clock. The layout of the tables, a long U with 20 seats on either side and 6 at the head. The menu, Chef Zhukovsky's interpretation of a traditional Russian feast. The wine, a Ukrainian white, and the necessity of dousing the candles at exactly 10:59. Then, perhaps to emphasize the evening's importance, Conrad Prop gave the Count a glimpse of the guest list. While it's true that the Count generally hadn't concerned himself with the inner workings of the Kremlin, that is not to suggest that he was unfamiliar with the names on that piece of paper, for he had served them all. Certainly he had served them at formal functions in the red and yellow rooms, but he had also served them at the more intimate and less guarded tables of the Boyarsky, when they had dined with wives or mistresses, friends or enemies, patrons or protégés. He knew the boorish from the abrupt and the bitter from the boastful. He had seen all of them, sober and most of them drunk. "All will be seen to," said the Count, as the young apparatchik stood to go. "But, Comrade Prop—" Comrade Prop paused. "Yes, head waiter Rostov, have I forgotten something? You haven't given me the seating arrangement." "Ah, not to worry. Tonight there is to be no seating arrangement." "Then rest assured," the Count replied with a smile, "the evening is bound to be a success." Why was the Count so pleased to hear that this dinner of state would have no seating arrangement? For 1,000 years, civilizations the world over have recognized the head of the table as a privileged spot. Upon seeing a formally set table, one knows, instinctively, that the seat at the head is more desirable than those along the sides, because it inevitably confers upon its occupant an appearance of power, importance, and legitimacy. By extension, one also knows that the farther one sits from the head, the less powerful, important, and legitimate one is likely to be perceived. So, to invite 46 leaders of a political party to dine around the periphery of an extended U without a seating arrangement was to risk a certain amount of disorder. Thomas Hobbes, no doubt, would have likened the situation to man in a state of nature, and would have counseled one to expect a scuffle. Born with similar faculties and driven by similar desires, the 46 men in attendance had equal right to any seat at the table. As such, what was most likely to ensue was a scrum for the head, animated by accusations, recriminations, fisticuffs, and, possibly, gunfire. John Locke, on the other hand, would argue that once the dining room's doors were opened, after a brief moment of confusion, the better natures of the 46 men would prevail, and their disposition to reason would lead them to a fair and orderly process of seat-taking. Thus, in all likelihood, the attendees would draw lots to decide their placement, or simply reconfigure the tables into a circle, just as King Arthur had, to ensure the equity of his knights. Chiming in from the mid-18th century, Jean-Jacques Rousseau would inform Messieurs Locke and Hobbes that the 46 guests, freed at long last from the tyranny of social conventions, would shove the tables aside, gather the fruits of the earth in hand, and share them freely in a state of natural bliss. But the Communist Party was not a state of nature. Quite to the contrary, it was one of the most intricate and purposeful constructions ever manufactured by man. In essence, the hierarchy of all hierarchies. So, when the guests arrived, the Count was fairly certain that there would be no raising of fists, drawing of lots, or free-spirited sharing of fruits. Rather, with only the slightest jostling and jockeying, each of the 46 attendees would find their proper place at the table. And this spontaneous arrangement would tell the studious observer all he needed to know about the governance of Russia for the next 20 years. At the Count's signal, the doors to Suite 417 were opened at precisely 9 p.m. By 9:15, 46 men of various rank and seniority were taking the seats appropriate to their station. Without a word of orchestration, the head of the table was left to Bulganin, Khrushchev, Malenkov, Mikoyan, Molotov, and Voroshilov, the six most eminent members of the party, with the two center seats reserved for Premier Malenkov and General Secretary Khrushchev. In fact, as if to make the point, when Khrushchev entered the room, he didn't even walk in the direction of the table's head. Rather, he exchanged a few remarks with Vyacheslav Malyshev, the rather mundane minister of medium machine building, who was sitting near the table's end. Only when everyone else was comfortable did the former mayor of Moscow pat Malyshev on the shoulder and casually work his way to the seat beside Malenkov, the last empty chair in the room. Over the next 2 hours, the men in attendance ate heartily, drank freely, and gave toasts that ranged in tone from the high-minded to the humorous, but always in the most patriotic of spirits. And, in between toasts, as the Count presented courses, refilled glasses, replaced utensils, whisked away plates, and swept crumbs from the linens, the attendees made asides to the men on their left, conferred with the men on their right, or muttered to themselves under the hum of the festivities. Upon reading this, you may be tempted to ask a little sardonically whether Count Rostov, the self-proclaimed man of propriety, allowed himself to overhear any of the private exchanges around the table. But your question and your cynicism would be entirely misplaced, For as with the best men servants, it is the business of capable waiters to overhear. Consider the example of Grand Duke Demidov's butler. In his day, Kemp could stand for hours at the edge of the library as silent and stiff as a statue. But should one of the Grand Duke's guests even mention that he was thirsty, Kemp was there with the offer of a drink. Should someone complain quietly of a chill, Kemp was at the fireside stirring the coals. And when the Grand Duke observed to a friend that while the Countess Shermatova was a delight, her son was unreliable, Kemp would know without being told that should either of the Shermatovas appear at the door unannounced, the Grand Duke was available to the one and indisposed to the other. So, did the Count overhear any of the private exchanges of the attendees? Did he hear any of the sly observations, pointed asides, or dismissive remarks uttered sotto voce? He heard every single word. Every man has his own personality at table, and one needn't have waited upon members of the Communist Party for 28 years to know that while Comrade Malenkov only toasted upon occasion, and then with a glass of white wine, Comrade Khrushchev would give 4 toasts in an evening, and always with vodka. Thus it did not escape the Count's notice that, during the course of the meal, the former mayor of Moscow never once rose to his feet. But at 11:10, when the meal was nearly over, the general secretary rapped on his glass with the blade of his knife. "Gentlemen," he began, "the Metropole is no stranger to historic events. In fact, in 1918, Comrade Sverdlov locked the members of the Constitutional Drafting Committee in the suite 2 floors below us, informing them that they would not be let out until their work was done." Laughter and applause. "To Sverdlov," someone called, and as Khrushchev emptied his glass with a self-assured grin, all around the table followed suit. "Tonight," continued Khrushchev, "we have the honor of witnessing another historic event at the Metropole. If you will join me at the windows, comrades, I believe that Minister Malyshev has an announcement." With expressions ranging from curious to bemused, the 44 other attendees pushed back their chairs and approached the great windows, overlooking Theater Square, where Malyshev was already standing. "Thank you, General Secretary," Malyshev said with a bow toward Khrushchev, followed by a weighty pause. "Comrades, as most of you know, 3.5 years ago we began construction of our new power plant in the city of Obninsk. I am proud to announce that on Monday afternoon the Obninsk facility became fully operational 6 months ahead of schedule." Appropriate commendations and the nodding of heads. "Furthermore," Malyshev continued, "at exactly 11 o'clock tonight, in less than 2 minutes, the plant will begin providing power to half the city of Moscow." With that, Malyshev turned and faced the windows, as the Count and Martin quietly snuffed the candles on the table. Outside, the lights of Moscow glimmered in the same old fashion, such that, as the seconds ticked by, the men in the room began shifting on their feet and exchanging remarks. But suddenly, in the far northwestern corner of the city, the lights in a neighborhood 10 blocks square went out, all at once. A moment later, the lights went out in the adjacent quarter. Then the darkness began moving across the city like a shadow crossing a plain, growing closer and closer until, at roughly 11:02, the eternally lit windows of the Kremlin went black, followed a few seconds later by those of the Metropole Hotel. In the darkness, the mutterings of a moment before rose in volume and shifted in tone, expressing some combination of surprise and consternation. But the attentive observer could see from Malyshev's silhouette that when the darkness fell, he neither spoke nor moved. He continued to stare out the window. And suddenly, in the far northwest corner of the capital, the lights of those initially darkened blocks flickered back on. Now it was luminescence that was moving across the city, growing closer and closer, until the windows of the Kremlin flashed on, followed by the chandelier overhead, and the combined dinner of the Presidium and the Council of Ministers erupted into justified applause. For in fact, the lights of the city seemed to burn brighter with the electricity from the first nuclear power plant in the world. On the night of the 16th of June, beside Sophia's empty suitcase and knapsack, the Count laid out all the various items that he had collected on her behalf. The night before, when she'd returned from rehearsal, he had sat her down and explained exactly what it was that she must do. "Why have you waited until now to speak of this?" she asked, on the verge of tears. "I was afraid if I told you earlier you would object." "But I do object." "I know," he said, taking her hands. "But oftentimes, Sophia, our best course of action appears objectionable at the first step. In fact, it almost always does." What followed was a debate between father and daughter on the whys and wherefores, a contrasting of perspectives, a comparison of time horizons, and heartfelt expressions of conflicting hopes. But in the end, the Count asked Sophia that she trust him, and this proved to be a request that she did not know how to refuse. So, after a moment of shared silence, with the courage that she had shown since the first day they'd met, Sophia listened attentively as the Count went over every detail, step by step. Tonight, as he finished laying out the items, the Count reviewed the same details for himself, to ensure that nothing had been forgotten or overlooked. And he was feeling at last that everything was in order when the door flung open.
"They've changed the venue!" Sophia exclaimed, out of breath.
Father and daughter traded anxious looks. "To what?" About to answer, Sophia stopped and closed her eyes, then opened them with a suggestion of distress.
"I can't remember."
"It's all right," assured the Count, knowing full well that distress was no friend to recollection. "What did the director say, exactly? Do you remember anything about the new location, any aspect of its neighborhood or name?"
Sophia closed her eyes again. It was a hall, I think? A salle?"
"The Salle Pleyel."
"That's it."
The Count breathed a sigh of relief. "Well, we needn't worry. I know the spot well. A historic venue with fine acoustics, which also happens to be in the 8th. So, as Sophia packed her bags, the Count went down to the basement. Having found the second Paris Baedeker, he tore out the map, climbed the stairs, sat at the Grand Duke's desk, and drew a new red line. Then, when all the straps were tightened and the latches snapped, with a touch of ceremony, the Count ushered Sophia through the closet door into the study, much as he had 16 years before. And just as on that occasion, Sophia said,
"Oh!"
For since she had set out earlier that afternoon to attend her last rehearsal, their secret study had been transformed. On the bookcase, a candelabra burned brightly. The two high-backed chairs had been set at either end of the Countess's oriental coffee table, which in turn had been draped with linen, decorated with a small arrangement of flowers, and set with the hotel's finest silver. "Your table awaits," said the Count with a smile, pulling out Sophia's chair.
"Okrushka?" she asked, as she put her napkin in her lap.
"Absolutely," said the Count, taking his seat. "Before one travels abroad, it is best to have a simple, heartwarming soup from home, so that one can recall it fondly, should one ever happen to feel a little low."
"I shall be sure to do so," said Sophia with a smile, "the minute I become homesick."
As they were finishing their soup, Sophia noticed that tucked beside the arrangement of flowers was a little silver lady in an 18th-century dress.
"What is that?" she asked.
"Why don't you see for yourself?" She picked up the little lady and, hearing the hint of a jangle, waggled it back and forth. At the sound of the resulting chime, the door to the study swung open, and in came André pushing a Regency cart topped with a silver dome.
"Bonsoir, monsieur. Bonsoir, mademoiselle." Sophia laughed.
"I trust you enjoyed the soup," he said.
"It was delicious."
"Très bien."
André whisked the bowls from the table and stowed them on the bottom shelf of his cart, as the Count and Sophia looked to the silver dome with anticipation. But when André stood back up, instead of revealing what Chef Zhukovsky had in store for them, he produced a pad.
"Before I serve the next course, I will need you to confirm your satisfaction with the soup. Please sign here and here and here."
The look of shock on the Count's face prompted a burst of laughter from both André and Sophia. And then, with a flourish, the maitre d' raised the dome and presented Emile's newest specialty, goose à la Sophia,
in which, he explained, the goose is hoisted in a dumb waiter, chased down a hall, and thrown from a window before being roasted.
André carved the bird,
served the vegetables, and poured the Chateau Margaux all in a single motion of the hands. Then he wished the diners bon appétit as he backed out the door. While the two enjoyed Emil's latest creation, the Count recalled for Sophia in some detail the commotion he had found on the fourth floor that morning in 1946, including the army-issue briefs that Richard van der Weyl had saluted. And this somehow led to a retelling of the time that Anna Urbanova threw all her clothes out the window, only to gather them back up in the middle of the night, which is to say they shared those humorous little stories of which family lore is made. Perhaps some will find this surprising, having supposed that the Count would reserve this particular dinner for an offering of the propolonial advice or expressions of heartache. But the Count had quite intentionally chosen to see to all of that the night before, after the discussion of what was to be done. Showing a sense of personal restraint that was almost out of character, the Count had restricted himself to two succinct pieces of parental advice. The first was that if one did not master one's circumstances, one was bound to be mastered by them. And the second was Montaigne's maxim that the surest sign of wisdom is constant cheerfulness. But when it came to expressing admissions of heartache, the Count had not held back. He told her exactly how sad he would be in her absence, and yet how joyful he would feel at the slightest thought of her grand adventure. Why was the Count so careful to ensure that all of this was covered on the night before Sophia's journey? Because well he knew that when one is traveling abroad for the first time, one does not wish to look back on laborsome instructions, weighty advice, or tearful sentiments. Like the memory of the simple soup, when one is homesick, what one will find most comforting to recall are those light-hearted little stories that have been told a thousand times before. That said, when their plates were finally empty, the Count attempted to broach a new subject that had clearly weighed on his mind. "I was thinking," amused to see her father so uncharacteristically flummoxed, Sophia laughed. "What is it, Papa? What might I like?" Reaching into his pocket, the Count sheepishly removed the photograph that Mishka had tucked into the pages of his project. "I know how you treasure the photograph of your parents, so I thought you might like a picture of me as well. It is the only one I have." Genuinely moved, Sophia accepted the photographs with every intention of expressing her deepest gratitude, but getting a look at the picture, she clapped a hand over her mouth and began to laugh. "Your mustaches," she blurted. I know," he said. "Although, believe it or not, at one time they were the envy of the jockey club." "All right, if you don't want it, I understand." But she gripped the picture to her chest. "I wouldn't part with it for the world." Smiling, she took another peek at the mustaches that looked up at her. "Whatever happened to them?" "What happened to them, indeed?" Taking a considerable drink of his wine, the Count told Sophia of the afternoon in 1922 when one of his mustaches had been clipped so unceremoniously in the barber shop. "What a brute!" "Yes. But in a way, of course, I have that fellow to thank for my life with you."
"What do you mean?"
The Count explained how, a few days after the incident in the barber shop, her mother had popped up at his table in the piazza to ask, in essence, the very same question that Sophia had just asked. Where did they go? And with that simple inquiry, their friendship had commenced. Now it was Sophia who took a drink of wine.
"Do you ever regret coming back to Russia? I mean, after the revolution?"
"Looking back, it seems to me that there are people who play an essential role at every turn, and I don't just mean the Napoleons who influence the course of history. I mean men and women who routinely appear at critical junctures in the progress of art or commerce or the evolution of ideas, as if life has itself summoned them once again to help fulfill its purpose. Well, since the day I was born, Sophia, there was only one time when life needed me to be in a particular place at a particular time, and that was when your mother brought you to the lobby of the Metropole. And I would not accept the czarship of all the Russias in exchange for being in this hotel at that hour." Sophia rose from the table to give her father a kiss on the cheek. At 10 o'clock, when the Count and Sophia snuffed the candles and returned to their bedroom, there was a delicate knock at the door.
The two looked at each other with the wistful smiles of those who know the hour has come. "Enter," said the Count. It was Marina, in her hat and coat.
"Sorry if I'm late."
"No, you're right on time." As Sophia took a jacket from the closet, the Count picked up her suitcase and knapsack from the bed. Then the three of them headed down the belfry to the fifth floor, where they exited, crossed the hallway, and continued their descent on the main staircase. Earlier that day, Sophia had already said her goodbyes to Arkady and Vasily. Nonetheless, they came out from behind their desks to see her off, and they were joined a moment later by Andrei in his tuxedo and Emil in his apron. Even Audrius appeared from behind the bar of the Shelyapin, leaving his customers unattended for a change. This little assembly gathered around Sophia in a circle of well-wishing, while feeling that touch of envy which is perfectly acceptable among family and friends from one generation to the next.
"You'll be the belle of Paris," one of them said.
"We can't wait to hear all about it. Someone get her suitcase for her. Yes, her train is leaving within the hour."
When Marina went outside to call for a taxi, as if by prior agreement, Arkady, Vasily, Audrius, Andrei, and Emil all fell a few paces back, so that the Count and Sophia could have a few final words alone. Then father and daughter embraced, and Sophia, despite being uncertain of a claim, passed through the endlessly spinning doors of the Metropole Hotel. Returning to the sixth floor, the Count spent a moment looking around his bedroom from corner to corner, finding that it already seemed unnaturally quiet. "So this is an empty nest," he thought. "What a sad state of affairs." Pouring himself a glass of brandy and taking a good swallow, he sat down at the Grand Duke's desk and wrote 5 letters on the hotel stationery. When he was done, the Count put the letters in the drawer. He brushed his teeth. He donned his pajamas, and then, despite the fact that Sophia was gone, he slept on the mattress under the bedspring. The book is A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles, T-O-W-L-E-S. It's published by Viking. I'm Jim Fleming. I hope you'll join me again next time for another chapter on Chapter a Day.